Hi, this is Paul. I'm going to do some more videos on the Jordan Peterson Bishop Barron conversation. There's a lot in this conversation that I think only becomes apparent when you sort of slow it down and hear what they're saying and think through some of the connections between them. And I found that to be especially true in this segment of the conversation. Let's hear where Peterson goes. This is pretty much following on the last video did on this conversation.
You know, I've talked to about 150 live audiences now about this sort of thing, independent of all my classroom lectures. And I'll tell you, I suggest to people that the ancient idea that life is suffering and that it's tainted by malevolence, that there's no more true ideas than that in some base sense. And that's something that everyone has to contend with. And if you don't contend with it properly, then you become embittered and you work to make things worse. And everyone understands that. Everyone knows that's true. And then I suggest to them that the proper way out of that isn't the pursuit of material satisfaction or impulsive happiness or rights from the individual perspective,
yeah,
but the adoption of responsibility. And
yeah,
I'll tell you, every single time I talk about that, you can hear a pin drop in the auditorium.
I believe that.
And I think one of the things that the church has failed to communicate properly is that you need a noble goal in life to buttress yourself against its catastrophe. And I mean, Abel's a good example of that in the Abel and Cain story, because he devotes himself properly to God and things work out for him. Well, they work out
more or less. It doesn't end very well.
No, it doesn't, but I mean, good is sometimes defeated by evil,
right.
But I mean, obviously he lives a proper and admirable life, and it needs to be communicated to young people.
Right. Well, see, I would say the biblical.
Okay. We'll get back to Bishop Barron's answer in a minute. But this is classic Jordan Peterson. Life is suffering. The proper way out is the adoption of responsibility. The church has failed to communicate this properly. And I want to dig into this because it's important. And I think actually they do dig into this, even though Bishop Barron is about to say, go into a section on right praise, which we will look at. And it's not necessarily clear why he's going into that until you pull back and you think about this idea of a noble goal. Now, Esther O'Reilly obviously has many times characterized Peterson as a noble pagan. And the longer I sit with that observation, the better it sits with me. Nobility is something that Peterson talks about regularly. Now, if you think about nobility, if you think about, let's say, Eric's conversation that he did with me, where Eric talked about that which is admirable, and I think I got that word right, that which is admirable, and we tend to move towards that which we have a sense is admirable or attractive or desirable, and we, this gets into some of mimetic. Why can't I think of his name? The Roman Catholic. We are attracted to that which is admirable, to that which is noble. And Peterson criticizes the church here a bit, and he does so with all due respect, I think. And Bishop Barron understands that, and I understand that, and I don't take it personally, because I think he has a point that the church has not, for many people in the culture, the church is not known as setting a high ideal. And I think this is in such a large, we have such large communities now, that isn't completely gone. Churches in surveys, pastors in surveys regularly fare a little better than politicians in terms of nobility, but not much. A little better than lawyers, but not much. Less than nurses. Nurses usually score higher than doctors. But the point here that Peterson makes is that, and this is one of the points that he makes regularly, what happens in life is if you set a goal, that goal begins to not only, if you set a goal, that goal not only begins to orient your behavior, begin to focus and sharpen and direct your behavior, it also focuses and sharpens and directs what you see. And so you'll hear Peterson again and again and say, set a goal, because that goal functions powerfully in terms of the world we actually begin to see. This gets into his ideas about cognitive science, and that goal then begins to reshape the world for the person, and they then everything they see the world differently. The world in many ways, as it appears to them, capital B being, as it appears to them, is reshaped by that goal. Okay, that's an important idea. Now where Bishop Barron will go with this is important. But before we get there, I want to let's see what I'm doing with these. I made these slides yesterday. I just finished the book Fatal Discord, and I heartily recommend this. This has been one of the best presentations of the Protestant Reformation by a journalist. Okay, it's not by a theologian, it's not by a church historian. When a church historian and a theologian write about, or a philosopher write about the Protestant Reformation, again, the goal begins to shape the nature of the book. What is powerful about this book is he takes a very broad perspective and he approaches it as a journalist. Now, there are things in the book that professional historians and theologians could certainly criticize and want to tweak. But in terms of giving a journalistic perspective of the importance of the Reformation and the scope of the Reformation, this has probably been the best book that I've read. Now, the Protestant Reformation was, in fact, all about the church. Now, the fact that I even have to say that says a lot about the impact of Martin Luther and the radical way in which Martin Luther changed, but also the time changed, and Martin Luther expresses that change. Does the man make the moment, or does the moment make the man? I had a conversation with Ron Dart about Erasmus and Luther, and I argued in that conversation that Peterson is more of a Luther in terms of his temperament, in terms of what he's done. Erasmus was a vitally important person, and I think this book gives Erasmus the attention he deserves. But what happened in the Protestant Reformation was very much a challenge to church as institution. And that has deep roots, and I want to make a video on that. I just did a class on that for my Sierra Leadership Network. But that has deep roots in terms of how we understand almost everything today. You go into, you leave the Middle Ages with a threat of afterlife torture was publicly plausible, near obsession for many. And so what the church offered was a way to handle afterlife jeopardy. And remember, in that day and age, life was short, brutish and hard, and people died all the time. And so the focus, the goal, okay, that shaped ideas, the focus on the afterlife very much shaped everything. And that's important to remember in this. And what the Roman Catholic Church offered was an institutional system to address this very plausible threat that many people, not everyone, that many people recognized. And so the church held tremendous power in the public imaginary for the people in Europe. Now the church's sacramental spiritual machinery was employed to deliver escape from hell, speed through purgatory, and delivery into the bliss of heaven. And this goal shaped the public imagination to powerful degrees. Now, part of the big reason for the Protestant Reformation was the incredible corruption within the church. And part of what the Protestant Reformation actually succeeded in doing was actually forcing the church to address the corruption that was endemic within the church. Now, how does that relate to this? Peterson, in this video with Bishop Barron, spend most of their time talking about what the church should be for today. And Peterson quite rightly here says that in his mind, the goal of the church is to present a noble goal for people that they can strive to. And the point that he's making in that, in his experience, and now again, I've said before, Peterson sort of Forrest Gumps his way through the church. He clearly has very little experience in church, very little understanding of what's been happening in the church over the last few hundred years. That lack of understanding is understandable because he's not been there. This has not been his focus. He does serve here, however, to give a low resolution, outside, quick take on what he sees as the deficiency of the church. Now part of this is certainly valid because he spent his growing up years in the church and left it. So in other words, the church was not salient to him, did not capture his imagination as a young boy. And in fact, right at that moment, perhaps when he was in need of a model or a goal, that didn't present itself plausibly within the church. He didn't, as a young boy who eventually, or as a young teenager who eventually left the church, in that sense, failed to capture his imagination, him and, frankly, an entire generation. And so his critique here, that the church has failed to not only set a noble goal ahead of people, but set an admirable goal, an attractive goal, a goal that engaged his youthful imagination. And Peterson's just a year older than I am. And so very much about that time, what really probably did grab his attention more was Luke Skywalker and Star Wars and the movies and all of those things. And we're going to talk about that as we go into this. But Peterson's point here that the church has failed to present to society an admirable, noble goal that could excite his young imagination and give him a sense that this church is a vital institution worth investing in. Now, I was speaking with a gentleman a generation older than myself who talked about how he grew up in the Christian Reformed Church and the Dutch Reformed tradition. He talked about how in his teenage and young adult years, now granted they grew up within a pretty rigid, insular, isolated container that the Christian Reformed Church was, especially prior to World War II. But he talked about how every week they were interested in going to church because they were curious about what the preacher was going to say. And he had the sense that somehow the service, the preaching, all of this engaged for him issues that were vital for his sense of well-being, his salient structure, and in many ways, for many people, this has been lost. And now the whole conversation within Christianity and church work about relevance is a complicated one, but I think it's apt here. And so what should the church be for today? And Peterson says, well, perhaps what the church needs to do is hold forth a noble goal. And again, now we're talking about nobility, virtue, and again, Esther O'Reilly's idea of Peterson as a noble pagan, a noble goal that would give young people something to aim at. And I do hear this, and you'll hear people bear witness to this in my conversations, that they met somebody in church that captured their imagination, whose virtue and nobility inspired young men and young women to stay within the church and work within the church as a fruitful way of pursuing nobility. And you can hear this in Jonathan Peugeot and how he talks about the church fathers and Nathan Jacobs too. I'm talking to John Verveke today. I'll be talking to Nathan Jacobs again next week. But for for Jonathan Peugeot, you can see how church fathers for him, when he converted to Orthodoxy, became the kind of noble saints that one would aspire to. If you listen to Peter Kreeft, you will hear Peter Kreeft again and again talk about, you know, it should be the goal to become saints. And part of what, at least before the Protestant Reformation, in terms of sainthood, there was certainly some of that. Now, so Peterson believes what the church should do. It should give them something to aim at, because you need that goal to reorient your sight and reshape the world that you see. That aiming would recalibrate what you see, and it would give their lives a sense of meaning. Okay, that's very much an antidote to nihilism. Now, Jordan Peterson is actually doing this, and I noted, I scanned the comments in his conversation with Bishop Barron, and just as I saw 2 years ago, year and a half ago, when Peterson caught my imagination, was that you'll see in the comments section again and again people bearing witness to the fact that they are going to church because they listen to Jordan Peterson. Their lives are better because they listen to Peterson. And they're doing better in life, generally speaking. And many have seen Peterson as that noble, you know, as that noble man to emulate. Now, Barron, when I first, probably the first 2-3 times I listened to this, I was a little disappointed at his response to this, how he followed up on the goal idea, because I thought he sort of missed it, and I thought he sort of jumped in to make a church point. But listening to this now, I don't think so. He goes right into right praise. And so let's listen to where Barron goes with this, and then we're going to talk about that.
Right. Well, see, I would say the biblical key is always right praise. And that's, I go right back to Genesis 1, is when we give praise to God, drawing all creation together, then our soul becomes ordered properly. And then around us, a kingdom of right order is built up.
Now, this idea is very similar to Peterson's modern scientific observation about attention and the way attention creates our world. Okay, and I know for some of you that's going to sound sort of woo, but Peterson has the gorilla video. If you read Maps of Meaning again, you'll see how he brings a lot of this stuff in. That which our, if you listen to Sam Harris, Sam Harris will say something like this. Sam Harris imagines that we are passive observers of a world of objects, okay? Now, cognitive science today has thrown out that idea. That is not at all how we relate to the world. And you can see this by listening to someone like Scott Adams, who will be say he has his two movies. So some people look at Trump and say he's an evil racist, a despot bent on destroying America. Others will look at Trump and say he is a liberator who is standing up to the despots of the left who are trying to establish a new progressive liberationist tyranny in America, a new blue tyrannical church, something to model the medieval church that Martin Luther, in a sense, destroyed. And so, well, who is Trump? So you've got these, in a sense, these two movies. And we would look at that and say, well, that's just interpretation. But as Peterson notes, and as cognitive science notes today, no, this goes way deeper, that the world we live in is actually a combination of that which is out there and that which we bring to it. Okay? And that combination of being, capital B, as Peterson says, This being that we experience is both and in terms of what we bring to the world and what the world brings to us. And you can see this again, one of my favorite clips of Peterson at the beginning of the Roger Scruton video, where he talks about the fact that, in a sense, what we see are memories. And you think, well, why is that? Well, if you actually understand how the eye works, we are, in a sense, this manifest image that we have before us. I'm sitting here and I'm looking at the computer and I'm seeing my entire office. That's not It's not, my eyes aren't actually operating like this little webcam that is recording me here, which is just kind of taking in a mindless array within a resolution of data that is sucking it in. My eyes are actually darting here and there, and they're paying attention to things. And so the salience is actually constructing this view before me. And we know that people see, just look at five observers to a car accident, and everyone will say, well, you get all of these different testimonies to it. Yeah, you do. Well, why is that? Were they not all seeing the same accident? No, they all saw it, but they were all quite literally looking at different things. And so our minds, our eyes, and our brains do not record as this webcam is recording. It's far more complicated than that, because we're actually taking in way more data than just this little webcam, and we're having to store it and interpret it, and we're having to figure out what is salient, and we're doing this all because we need to survive. And again, if a chimpanzee walked in my office, chaos would reign, and you know, everything in my mind would be drawn to that. If someone in right outside my office fired a gun and a bullet came through my office door, same thing, and I would duck before my conscious self has a chance to see it. All right, now, when Bishop Barron talks about right praise and Jordan Peterson talks about a goal, they're really talking about the same thing. Bishop Barron has just said what right praise is supposed to do is orient the self properly. Again, this is very much the same thing that Jordan Peterson has been saying about a goal. Now, maybe we should listen to a little bit more.
In the Catholic Mass, we have that wonderful prayer of the Gloria. We say, glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace to people of goodwill. And it's like a formula that if I give glory to God in the highest, then there will be peace around me.
And again, this is the same thing that Jordan Peterson has just said, but he's saying it in religious language, and this religious language is problematic for a tremendous number of people. Now, someone might say, well, I can see Jordan Peterson and he appears to be noble. I got the two movie thing with Jordan Peterson. I regularly, if I mentioned a Jordan Peterson to people sort of outside the Jordan Peterson bubble, I will get comments. I'll get comments like, you're just offering a cover for racism. And I'm thinking, do you know my life? Why on earth would I want to offer a cover for racism? I've seen racism as a desperate problem and a bitter enemy all my life. Why would I want to give it cover? Actually, just last night on NewsHour, one of the reporters, for the first time I've heard on NewsHour, said, well, it seems like the Republicans and the squad of four have two different definitions of racism. I'm like, ah, we're upping the resolution here a little bit. What is racism? We're going to have a conversation about that definition. But anyway, so Bishop Barron says that, you know, this orienting thing, this right praise is supposed to orient our whole lives. The difficulty of this is that what has been lost in the imaginary is God. This gets into Nietzsche. God is dead. God can't be seen. And in fact, what has happened, at least since the end of the Cold War and 9/11 and the rise of the new atheist, which is very much a function of 9/11, if you look at the time frame, God, as imagined in the Roman Catholic Church, is immoral. And so the death of God leads us right into, now there's a big debate as to whether Peterson gets Nietzsche right. But the point that Peterson makes here is an important one, that God is absent. And what I have noticed pastorally is that for most people, even if they have an idea of God, God is corrupt. The Roman Catholic pedophile priest scandal bears into this. The political engagement of the religious right gets into this, because people who are on the opposite side politically then lose all respect. If they hate Trump, they'll lose all respect for Jerry Falwell Jr., who is seen as Trump's puppet, and churches that seem to align with that. There's all of these reasons that are pulling God down from the sky. And what I find most common with people in terms of, gotta keep my eye on the time here. What I find most common with people is that they truly believe they are more moral than God. And so they stand in judgment over God's church and over God himself, which means that basically at the top of their moral hierarchy, it's them. I read a fascinating, I'm going to make a video about that. I've got a whole bunch of videos in my head. And part of the reason I've slowed down conversations is because the conversations were sort of crowding out my ability to make these videos. And I need to have a balance. I want to have a balance of conversations and these videos, because while I love the conversations and I always come away with them thinking, wow, it was a great conversation, I'm so glad I had it, they are very taxing on me. And these monologue videos tend to sort of restore me. So I need a balance to. Anyway, back to this point. The church has been torn down. And so God is dead. Priests are seen as pedophiles. Pastors are seen as tribal money grubbers who they can't speak honestly because they'll lose their job or they'll lose their status, what have you. And churches, in fact, have become places where people can't speak honestly because they'll lose status. So nobility is something that has gone away. And so when Jordan Peterson says the church has failed to present a noble goal that would reorient, Bishop Aaron comes and says, well, right praise. So God is at the top and glory to God in the highest. And this is supposed to instruct us. But that's not how it's functioning for people. It's been corrupted. And, you know, one of the things I hope to talk to John Vervaeke about is, you know, if you listen to John Vervaeke and a number of other people that I've had conversations with, some of which I've posted, for many of those people, it can't be restored. The question is going to be, what is actually functioning in its place? Because something is always functioning in its place. And so now, This transition, as I said, why he goes to write praise, this point I think it was a little too subtle for me to catch the first time, but after listening to this a number of times, I caught it. He'll quote Tillich, and Tillich making the point that worship, and this is an old pastor thing, worship is worthship. We praise that which we see as most admirable, most esteemable, most noble, most glorious. Worship expresses that which the heart is fixed upon. This will get into our deal of idolatry. That which one worships shows the implicit goal of one's heart. And if you listen to, for example, I should grab the book. Hang on. So when I was in my Tim Keller phase, so when I first started listening to Tim Keller in 2006, I heard a lot of Christianity versus religion. Pastors go through these phases. They have these hobby horses. And so I'm in the Jordan Peterson phase right now. And one phase will lead to another. But for a while then, after his religion versus Christianity phase, he had his idolatry phase. And a lot of Tim Keller's books reflect the phase that he was in and the preaching that he was in. And he wrote this book, Counterfeit Gods. And this gets into idolatry. If you make the family the center of your life, that idol is going to hurt you, and you will actually hurt your family. And actually, Tim Keller is working from Augustine's idea of ordered loves, and this is actually what Bishop Aaron is saying. You have to have your hierarchy in order, and you have to have God at the top. And if God is at the top, here's the thing about God: if you love your family too much, you can corrupt it and it can corrupt you. But God, that which is incorruptible, that which is above all of these, well, this gets complicated philosophically, that which is above all of this stuff can't be corrupted, and therefore God is the safest thing to give your primary love. That doesn't mean you don't love your family or you don't love your spouse or you don't love your children. It's just that you have them in the proper order. And if you have them in your proper order, your love of these things won't turn around to kill you. And again, you can find all kinds of Tim Keller sermons on that and his book, Counterfeit Gods, which was on that, the empty promises of money, sex, and power, and the only hope that matters. And again, what a lot of preachers do is they take a lot of their ideas from their sermons and they put them into books like this. So, and that's the point that Barron is making. That which one worships shows the implicit goal of one's heart. If you decide you want to be a wealthy person, that will orient, that will become your goal. It will orient your life. If you decide you want to be someone who doesn't lie, well, then becoming not a liar will orient your heart. Let's see if I put a, I did put, let's see where he's.
Right. Well, see, I would say the biblical key is always right praise. And that's, I go right back to Genesis 1, is when we give praise to God, drawing all creation together, then our soul becomes ordered properly. And then around us, a kingdom of right order is built up. In the Catholic Mass, we have that wonderful prayer of the Gloria. We say, glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace to people of goodwill. And it's like a formula that if I give glory to God in the highest, then there will be peace around me.
That's like a condensation of the Sermon on the Mount. That sermon seems to see, that sermon seems to me, and I also believe it to be psychologically true, is that it's necessary for you to aim at the highest value that you can conceive of, you know, and that has to have something to do with the amelioration of suffering and the constraint of malevolence.
It'll express itself that way naturally, yeah.
At least as a negative. And then once you concentrate on that and focus on that and decide that that's your primary aim, then things do start to order themselves around you because everything that you see and do directs itself towards that aim.
But that's the strangely and uniquely Christian thing is that we say, okay, the God that we're worshiping.
Okay, and right there, that's exactly where most people will stumble. The God that you're worshiping. Okay, once you use that word God, for a lot of secular people, the problematic thing comes. If he would say, well, the thing that you're worshiping, the thing that you are turning into a God, I find people are less allergic to that kind of formulation.
The God revealed in the Old Testament, but then finally revealed in Jesus Christ.
And again, so much of this for so many people is so problematic. And now, I'm with Bishop Barron. For me, what he just said is not problematic. But for many, many people, it is. And so one of the things that I've gone back and forth with Adam Friended on many times is, why is Jordan Peterson having the effect that he has? And Adam will keep saying, he doesn't require people to believe in the supernatural. And that's right here at this moment, that Peterson seems to be affording a sort of natural theology where you can understand this without having to talk about revelation, because for many people, revelation is problematic.
As I'm looking over my computer screen right now, I'm looking at the crucifix of Jesus, right? So my praise is directed to a God who's entered radically into suffering, not just physical suffering, but the whole brokenness of the world, of stupidity and
now Bishop Barron is addressing what Peterson had just said about suffering.
Cruelty and injustice and hatred, that's where God has gone. So the God that I worship is the God who himself is dedicated to the amelioration of suffering or of healing the suffering of the world.
Now again, this whole framework, which for religious people is non-problematic, for many other people, it's highly problematic for a lot of these reasons that I've talked about in many of the videos. And so the church says you ought to praise God. Well, people naturally praise and evangelize that which they find brings them good things. They'll sell Amway. They'll sell essential oils. They'll tell you to shop at Costco. They'll tell you to vote for a certain politician. People naturally promote that which they see as noble and good and worthwhile. This is a function of human beings, and it's a function of how we teach. In this culture of expressive individualism, it's allergic to ought, however, in this way. Now, we'll say it ought as a recommendation, but ought as something that you will be punished if you don't do it. This tends to, in our culture, rearrange this whole economy of admirability. And so this is exactly what churches have been sort of working on. And so it's ironic when Peterson begins by, well, the churches should set ahead of them a noble goal. And a little bit later, actually, no, I won't treat it in this video because they actually talk about most of what they talk about in this video between Peterson and Bishop Barron is in fact the church. And most of what they're trying to figure out, I think, is very close to what I'm trying to figure out. Why has Jordan Peterson been so successful when the church has been struggling in many ways? Now, I always have to qualify that because Jordan Peterson, though he might seem huge in terms of having 2 million subscribers on YouTube and 2 million followers on Twitter, that is a drop in the bucket compared to the church, okay? Millions and millions of people go to church every Sunday, and around the world, billions of people are interested in church. And so when we talk about the relative performance between Jordan Peterson and the church, that has to be qualified within a particular subset of people who have been highly church resistant in our culture for at least 20 years. The culture of expressive individualism is allergic to ought in this way. People say, show me, and this again gets into Peterson's idea of a noble goal. Pervasive skepticism about the Christian program or the church's claims very much get into this. See, I didn't have a... And you can look at this in terms of church growth, and I use this slide for something else, and you can see where the rise of the nuns since, again, the end of the Cold War and really the beginning of the struggle with fundamentalist Islam. The Roman Catholic priest scandal, the end of recruiting God to fight godless communism, and now religious fundamentalism seems to be the enemy of goodness for many people in America, especially as seen via, I find this very much to be those who live very much within a media bubble, and social media hasn't really changed that. And so you see this huge rise of the no religion, and that's something that I really want to talk to Nathan Jacobs more about. But one of the things that you've seen, however, is that that which is noble, the different approaches to this. So Jordan Peterson, when he was at Liberty University, one of the things that he said there a number of times was how impressed he was visiting the college that the students were cynical, and how moved he was by the praise that was happening. Now, what Liberty University is going to do with its student body is very much going to be contemporary praise and worship. And what it does is it brings all of the musical and theatrical technology, this is something evangelicals tend to major on, takes all of that theatrical technology and brings it to the fore to give people an experiential, participatory sense of the presence of God. And if you're around any group of people, often Pentecostal, often big box, non-denominational, big sound church, they employ different technologies to, in a sense, break the kind of humdrum way of life and have you feel God and feel God's praise and feel God's glory. Now, the liturgical churches have been using older technologies to do that. In many ways, the liturgy of the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics and the other liturgical traditions, they're using other technologies. They're using Lectio Divina. They're using a lot of these older technologies to give people an experience of God, an experience of the noumenal, a sense of awe, a first-person experience of God's nobility and God's wonder. That's what worship does. And the idea is that, again, like Bishop Barron, if you sort of put God at the top, that everything will fall in line. Now, given the diverse and conflicted environment we're in, not everybody is impressed by what they're seeing. Now, again, if I talk to people who continue, for example, to be very happy with their experience as a practicing Jew or a practicing Islamist, they will talk about similar things, that, oh, but the church is so beautiful. Oh, but the language is so beautiful. Oh, but the prayer times are so important. And one of the things, part of what's happened since way before the Reformation, but pietism arose in the Reformation, and you can see in the Counter-Reformation sort of how the Roman Catholic Church tried to stem the tide of Protestantism, whereas Luther now was using the Bible. And part of why the Roman Catholic Church resisted the translation of the Bible in the vernacular was that the Bible was being used as a psychotechnology that people themselves would have an immediate experience of the noble, of the transcendent, and that was being done through the Bible. And in terms of participatory, you look at the Radical Reformation, and those who were, you know, people give biblical literalism a hard time, but the power of biblical literalism is in fact participatory, because you try to do exactly what Jesus says. You try to live exactly how Jesus lived, and then you discover, now remember what happens when you have a goal and everything orients towards this goal, when you try to live exactly that way and you find it works. What do you mean that it works? I mean, you begin hitting some of your sub-goals as a part of participating in the Bible in a very literal way. Well, it works. This is powerful stuff in terms of orienting your hierarchy. And churches have been, there have been movements within the churches for centuries doing these things. Now they get into this interesting part of this video where they start talking about Israel worshiping the wrong things. Let's see if I do have a clip here.
But see, I think that's the master theme of the whole Bible. Israel always goes wrong without exception when its praise goes wrong. Mm-hmm. It starts praising the wrong things. So
that's
running
what happens in Exodus when Moses leads the Israelites through the desert, right? They're in the same position we're in the modern world, where we've escaped a tyranny of sorts, let's say, or we believe we have, and entered into this domain of untrammeled freedom. And there's nothing but false idols calling to us from every direction. And
false idols. Now, again, there's a hierarchy here. And if your goal is noble, the sub-goals, and if your love the right thing, your sub-loves, all of this is going to arrange itself properly in a hierarchy. That's the idea. And if you start just worshiping any old thing that comes your way, if you, okay, I have, you know, oh, wow, pot, I discovered pot. And when I smoke pot, all of my problems seem to go away. Well, okay. But if all you do is smoke pot, your problems don't really go away. They just feel like they go away. Same thing with alcohol. Well, when I drink, I don't feel my problems. Yeah. But when you're sober, the problems come back. Now, one of the things that has come back into my life is Daniel. And Daniel is the guy who used to sleep against my door. And he can't sleep against my door right now because there's a restraining order. He's not allowed to go onto the church grounds because of an incident that happened. But he's back in the neighborhood, and I'm going to try and see if I can help him again. I most often fail. But one of the things that for Daniel was always the case, that he was terrified of waking up sober. Because, and now of all the stuff, all of this stuff has happened since Daniel went to jail, and now Daniel's out of jail. So, you know, and working through all of this stuff, helping all what I've learned about cognitive science and all of this stuff, you know, in a sense, you know, alcohol is this thing that changes the world for Daniel. Okay, the world is different because of alcohol for him. And so I remember one day he says, you know, I woke up sober. And so his goal is to just keep enough alcohol in his body to never be sober. And in terms of that, this being, as Peterson would say, capital B, being that we live in, he wants to keep enough alcohol so that that which he projects stays ahead of that which is out there. Now, unfortunately, I just saw him this morning, and his feet are swollen, and he's starting to lose his toenails. They're coming off his feet. He often doesn't wear shoes because his feet hurt so much, but that means he walks around on hot Sacramento sidewalks in the summer, and he often breaks beer bottles where he's sleeping because he throws them at people, and then there's broken glass around, and then he steps on the glass. But as long as he can stay sober, he can, in a sense, keep the things he's bringing to the world out here, and, you know, keep the world at bay.
That's the diversity idea, as far as I'm concerned, because unity is certainly as profound a moral necessity as diversity. There should be diversity within unity. And
I fight it all the time, you know, in the church too, because we bought into that ideology. And I should look
at now, again, in subsequent videos, and I hope I make subsequent videos because I always have these intentions, but I get distracted because I'm ADHD and I go off and make other videos. But the point here is that the church, they will critique the church a lot in this whole conversation. And that's really, in many ways, the themes of this conversation. And
it's the oldest problem in philosophy, the one of the many. But all we do today is we completely valorize the many. We never see its shadow side. We denigrate the one and never see its positive side. Mm-hmm. The one is extraordinarily important.
Well, that's part of the death of God.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's right. It's part of the death of God, because in a sense, what you do when you have God at the top of your hierarchy is that, again, as Peterson says in the first biblical series, where he talks about what the Christians did was they didn't divinize the emperor. And they didn't divinize, well, they come close to it in the Roman Catholic tradition, divinizing the Pope. And to the degree that you divinize a human being, your system breaks down, because people are people. They're broken, they're flawed, they do wrong, we get things wrong. And in a sense, and this is what goes into the Protestant Reformation, if you divinize your church hierarchy, well, what happens when they get things wrong? Because time is an incredibly difficult thing. And part of what happens in the Protestant Reformation is they sort of divinize the Bible, and they put that at the top of the hierarchy. And so part of what you're seeing as the new atheism, and as the rise of the nuns and atheism in general, and the falling away, and why I often say that atheism is a function of Protestantism, if you divinize the Bible and then you decide to rise up and judge the Bible, well, now you have the death of God. And so Israel worships the wrong thing. There's a religious frame that has been shattered by pluralism. And this, again, is something that the Protestant Reformation did. And this is part of the reason why, you know, people look at a particular institution, they say, nope, we all become judgers, we all become evaluators, we all become, to become a consumer is to become a critic. And I will shop for the church that is worthy of me, the church that gives me enough attention. Who is to say your God is better than my God? And that's kind of the pluralism, the one in the many issue. The tail end manifestation of worship might not arise for 100 years in a day when average life expectancy was 30. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, Israel worships the golden calf. Well, the golden calf, making a golden calf and saying, here is the God that took you out of Egypt, that was not a dumb thing. And now in many Christian teaching and in many atheist teaching, they'll say, oh, those ancient people were so dumb by worshiping a statue. Actually, it's not dumb at all, because we do the same things that they did. But it very much matters that which is at the top of the hierarchy, but it might not matter in your lifetime. And that's something that it's very difficult for an egalitarian, individualist society to consider. And this is the kind of thing, again, that Tim Keller talks about in his book, Counterfeit Gods. That which you put on the top of your hierarchy will probably be manifest in multiple generations, in hundreds of years rather than decades, because life works that slowly. Now, one of the things that happens in Israel is that if you read the Old Testament, you'll discover that the Bible has a critique of the other nations around it. You know, a popular take on the Mosaic Covenant by people today is that, well, it seems beyond archaic. Now it's immoral. Again, this is the big swing away from God after the Cold War, after the suspicion of fundamentalisms, either as God's word or once and for all thing. And you'll hear this debated in the Jordan Peterson, Brett Weinstein, Sam Harris conversations. It's interesting because when you get to, I almost said Charles Murray, I didn't mean Charles Murray, Douglas Murray, is that Douglas Murray is in Europe seeing the post-religious and beginning to say, well, there might be stuff in the Bible we don't like, but Nietzsche's project of making up our own values, we very quickly, John Calvin said, our minds are idol makers. So what did he mean by that? Well, we can't live without value hierarchies. And in fact, to watch someone like my homeless, alcoholic, drug-using friend Daniel, and, you know, whenever I talk about Daniel, please understand, I love Daniel a lot, and I want the best for him, and I try every day to set up a situation where he can get sober. And because he's had decades in his life of sobriety, he was a mental health worker, and so he understands his mental health situation and all of that. So I very much want to move him towards a far more sustainable life. But the thing is that we are idol makers. And if you want to see this, watch the presidential candidates have to establish a priority on stage when they don't have to choose. I was watching the Democratic debates, and the reporters try to get them to basically say, give us one priority. And it seems like, well, no one there understands what a priority is. No one there wants to deal with a hierarchy. Well, it's all important. Yeah, but without a hierarchy, it's hard to know what to do now or when to have a rule and when to have an exception. So this is sort of what's happened. So the popular take on the Mosaic Covenant is that, well, it's beyond archaic, it's immoral, either it's God's, you know, God's word once and for all, so we can't believe it, And so when you hear Sam Harris attacking fundamentalism, Brett Weinstein quite rightly comes in and says, yeah, but Christians have changed their behaviors. Even if they're not changing their language on the Bible, they're changing their behaviors and their interpretive frameworks for that behavior. That's changing all the time, actually, even amongst people who will say there's nobody more literal than them, and there's nobody that holds the Bible in higher regard than them, so on and so forth. Or it's watered down by interpretation to mean that whatever the interpreter wants it to believe. And so Peterson basically says, you know, these are false idols calling from every direction. And so then you have a life that is disordered. And so, well, now I'm into this, and now I'm into that, and now I'm in love with this woman, and now I'm in love with that man, but next year it'll be someone else, and whatever works for me. But when we say whatever works for me, it's whatever works for me now. And even in the course of a short lifetime, Rod Dreher posted an article a couple of years ago by a philosopher who had an article about pilgrims versus tourists. And that was actually a lovely piece because, you know, a pilgrim is someone who has a goal, and that goal orients their steps, and all of their decisions are towards that goal. Tourists are sort of all over the place, and there's a separation, an alienation, a disassociation with identity with a tourist. The tourist sort of floats above, whereas the pilgrim inhabits. And what happens with these false idols is that today I'm into Jordan Peterson, and tomorrow I'm into Tim Keller, and on and on and on. And if there's no me that is able to actually integrate Tim Keller and Jordan Peterson and John Vervaeke and C.S. Lewis and Frederick Buechner and Stan Vanderclay, my father, and Henry Osterman, my, you know, grandfather, and on and on and on and on. If there's nothing that actually integrates them, then I'm no longer a pilgrim, I'm just a tourist. The idol is a goal that you take on, but it's too small to properly orient your life. It's too shallow to function in the enthralling way it needs to. Your goal has to fascinate you, and it has to be noble, and it has to attract you, and you want to have to aspire to it. And part of the reason God's way up here and above us is that we need to aspire our whole life long. If I decide I want to be the best, I want to be the most successful YouTuber who has made a name for his cell phone stand, mission accomplished. I don't know any other YouTuber that's talking about a cell phone stand like this that has this. My dyslexia really makes it hard to know what side things are on when I'm looking at me. You know, this cell phone stand. Oh, there it is. There it is. That's a too small a goal for a human being. Human beings are fallen royalty. So in a sense, if your goal is above everything that's below, it's something that can actually orient one's life to have a noble life. So idols are goals that are too small. It's a good thing, but it's not an ultimate thing. Your family, having a good family is an important goal, but it can't be everything your life is about, or actually you will cripple your family. So what their tactic is, and what's interesting, is their tactic is cultural exegesis.
And
yeah, and they're all over the culture. That's been a presupposition of mine doing this work, is I tend not to begin with, you know, direct instruction or moral finger wagging, but I tend to begin with something going on in the culture. And you've talked about this, you know, the hero myth is in practically every movie you watch, but the Christian themes are every place. One of the most remarkable to me being, I just saw it on TV the other night, was the Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino. If you want to see the best exemplification, I think, in fiction of what the church fathers meant by the meaning of Jesus' cross, In other words, a move of self-sacrificing love that exposes evil and liberates those who are under the tyranny of evil. That's how they read the cross, in a very clever way, expressed in more mythic language, you know, but the ideas are very powerful and they're beautifully exemplified in that movie. Mm-hmm. The move that Eastwood's character makes at the end. And of course, as he dies, he's in the figure of the crucified Jesus. Right, lest we miss the point.
Right, but he's such an it's so interesting too, because I actually made a video where I used a picture of Christ delivering the Sermon on the Mount, I think, and I put Clint Eastwood's face, I superimposed it on top of his, and it was for exactly that reason. It was that the reason that's exemplified in Gran Torino.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Eastwood in that movie he's a very harsh character, very, very judgmental. He's like the Christ that comes back in Revelations, right? He's very, very, very judgmental.
Right.
And he cuts no one a break, except that he actually does. Like, he does separate the wheat from the chaff. And he's even, interestingly, in that movie, you know, he ends up being more akin to the foreigners who he hypothetically hates, like who's the Good Samaritan. It's the same idea as the Good Samaritan.
Right.
He becomes more family to these people that he hypothetically hates than to his own children, because he regards them as ungrateful and unworthy. And whereas these new immigrants are striving to be good people.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting movie.
Oh yeah, it is. And it was a good example of a principle. One of my professors years ago said, the once integrated Christian vision, let's say it, Reformation, the Enlightenment, sort of blew up and the pieces flew every place and they're kind of twisted and they're charred and everything, and they've landed here and there. And so as you go through the cultural landscape, you see them all over the place. Well, there's a bit of, you know, eschatology, or there's Christology, or there's the Trinity and so on, but they're usually in distorted form. So that's a good example of, there's the Christus Victor theory, to give it its proper name, that Christ is the victor over sin and death. He's conquered the dark powers. And liberated us in the process. There it is, but it's in somewhat distorted form, of course. But that's been the game I played a lot, is to try to find these.
Well, bits. It happens everywhere. It's so common that it's
Well,
it isn't merely common. It's universal, because you and this is of course one of the reasons that I became so deeply interested in archetypes, is that if the story doesn't have an archetypal foundation, then it's not a story. I mean, something makes something a story.
It's
not just a random collection of statements or images. And so it has an archetypal structure. And you know, I think what's happened in the modern world, at least partly, is this fractionation that you've described, but also something that a student once made me think deeply through. She came up and asked me after a class, well, if these archetypal stories are the fundamental element, let's say, of psychobiological reality, then why not just tell the archetypal story over and over again? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, first of all, to some degree, that is what cultures did for a long time. They repeated the archetypal story. But in our modern culture, what literature seems to do is to take the archetypal story and to bring it closer to the individual. It's like it's brought closer to earth.
I wouldn't say it's closer to the individual. Yeah, but it's embedded in our time, or embedded in a time, which in fact brings it closer to the individual, because it's easier for each of us to appropriate.
Almost like the Renaissance paintings brought the divine figures closer to earth.
And when Martin Luther wrote his Luther Bible, I mean, he used the language of the political and economic actors and translated the biblical text into those languages. And in fact, the translation of the Bible into the vernacular does this very same thing. Now, TVs and theater have become the cultural altars, and they are serving up the archetypal stories and delivering them to the masses. And in fact, part of the reason that people will watch Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino and he'll be a noble character. And so part of the Jesus archetype will be manifest in this story with Clint Eastwood. And this is why, even though someone says, well, I don't believe in God, but you watch Gran Torino and you say, yeah, noble. Like Bishop Barron said, Christianity is all over this stuff. And Sam Harris's ideas that he's using to critique the Bible itself, those ideas came from Christianity. His whole moral framework is a Christian moral framework in many ways, in many respects. And to say that isn't true, well, go to another place in the world and compare it to theirs. Take a look at ancient Rome or ancient Greek. Are there elements of Greco-Roman nobility within it? Yeah, they were all part of this stream coming in there, but it's all this stuff was part of the stream. You're not going to tease it out. And so what happens with these stories is, as I love that story. Peterson has told it multiple times. And I think about that point that he makes there often, that part of the reason you can't tell an archetypal story is that it needs to be incarnate. The archetype is the formal cause. It's the conversation where I like to say gestalt. It's the gestalt. Verveke talks about it. It's the thing that gives the chair, the chairness. And that's what's coming in. And that's why we see Jesus when, you know, in all these different ways, when we see someone giving to the poor, or we see someone, we watch the Amish, who again are fundamentalists by anyone's definition, the Amish who forgive the school shooter who killed a bunch of their daughters, and the Amish people set up a scholarship fund for the shooter's children. And we see that and we say, noble. I want to be noble, but how can you become noble? Well, you become noble by having a noble ideal, by having a noble goal. In a sense, what's happening is movies are presenting to us many images up there, and inside of us, our consciousness congresses having debates about nobility, because it's very, very complicated. And even past heroes, hagiography is to write a history of something that in a sense is willing to distort the image to turn somebody else into a more noble figure. And so part of why I've enjoyed Fatal Discord is it doesn't hide Luther's anti-Semitism or the things that he said in the peasant uprising and all of those issues. But what happens, this is very Aristotelian, we look at all of these examples and we take a goal out of it and we say, there it is. But then we test that goal against other goals. And this is what we're constantly doing with each other. So these archetypal stories are delivered to the masses, and it's where people give their tithes and offerings to Netflix and Regal Cinema just down here in Delta Shores, and where the zeitgeist is shaped for the next generation. And of course, people are doing this intentionally with all of these propagandist stories that try to instill the correct morals into the younger generation. The church has failed to demand its members to pursue a noble goal, Peterson says. Hollywood writers and directors and producers are priests of today. The church is reduced to religious nagging, quivering pastors as quivering masses of availability, stubborn obstinacy amongst, you know, people who are, I'm not going to give up my worldview because Sam Harris says it isn't intellectually coherent. I'm going to double down. Evangelical Me Too-ism that, well, if they have smoke machines, we have smoke machines. If they have cartoons, we have cartoons. The church needs to embody the story that it has, to embody Christ. I mean, churches have said this for years. We are to become Christ to the world.
You know, I've talked to about 150 live audiences now about this sort of thing, independent of all my classroom lectures. And I'll tell you, I suggest to people that the ancient idea that life is suffering and that it's
something that in much of our commercial environment we try to disregard. And so when he says life is suffering, there's sort of a freshness about it, because we walk around with this entitlement that I shouldn't have to suffer.
It's tainted by malevolence, that there's no...
And that people are basically good, and that people won't do cruel and terrible things to each other. We all that know that to be true, because people do it most of all sometimes in the families. People will be cruel to their spouses and to their family members than they would ever dare be cruel to anyone else.
More true ideas than that, in some base sense. And that's something that everyone has to contend with. And if you don't contend with it properly, then you become embittered and you work to make things worse.
And you become cynical and nihilistic and you work to make things worse because you just want to see the world burn.
Everyone understands that. Everyone knows that's true. And then I suggest to them that the proper way out of that isn't the pursuit of material satisfaction or impulsive happiness or rights.
It isn't even the pursuit of rights, to get my rights. That's not the pursuit of it.
The individual perspective, yeah. But the adoption of responsibility. And yeah. I'll tell you, every single time I talk about that, you can hear a pin drop in the auditorium.
No, I believe that.
And
now, I'll have to say that churches do talk a lot of responsibility.
I think one of the things that the church has failed to communicate properly is that you need a noble goal in life to buttress yourself against its catastrophe.
You need a noble goal in life to buttress yourself against its catastrophe. And the church has failed to embody this. A new orientation yields a better life. Reorientation yields better results. You are in line with the patterns.
Vengeful, nihilistic, cynical, and also possessed by a kind of inertia that made them immobile during the most vital part of their youth. And, you know, they told me, look, I decided I was going to develop a vision for my life. I was going to imagine what things could be. And then I was going to try to tell the truth, and I was going to try to act responsibly and not in a praying in public manner, but in a manner that began with cleaning up.
Not a praying in public manner. That's right out of the Sermon on the Mount.
My room, say, a fairly humble act. And then comes the kicker. And this is one of the things that's kept me going through this entire 150 city tour. They all say, and my life is way better. It's like, I'm healthy. My job is going well. I've had 3 promotions. I'm making twice as much money. I've spoken to my father. I haven't talked to him for 10 years. I'm putting my family together. It's like good things are just happening left, right, and center. And I mean, I have amazing stories.
You're in touch with the deepest rhythms of reality. It's an ethical move, but it's a metaphysical move. As you mentioned, the Sermon on the Mount of the Lord, I mean, that's how I look at it, is it's not just giving, you know, moving ethical recommendations. It's trying to get us aligned to the fundamental nonviolence of things. I mean, the fundamental move of God as he gives rise to the world. And so, of course, your life comes together. Again, right praise gets you online and knits you back together. That theme to me is really strong in the spiritual tradition of the knitting back together of the splintered self.
That's why, like, you know, of things.
Do you? I mean, as a psychotherapist, you deal all the time with this. But like in the scriptures, so you mentioned Satan. You know, Satanas is the accuser, and there's a lot to that. But the other great word for the dark power is the diabolos, right? The scatterer, the one that divides and separates. And so the demons always speaking in the plural in the New Testament. And Jesus bringing them back to themselves, back to the center. But that's all of us sinners. I mean, we're all over the place. Our mind and will and passions and sexuality and body, they're all going different directions. And then it's the right...
It's disorienting for people. It's very confusing and anxiety provoking to be going in all those directions at the same time.
Right. And that's, what do you want of us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? You know, and the answer is yes, I have come to destroy this disparate reality and knit you back together. So see, go back to Nietzsche for a second, because I want to ask you about that.
We'll save that for another time. There's skepticism about the church's spiritual program. What does that mean? Because the church talks in a way that says another power can come upon you. Now, we're skeptical about that, but other people who have experienced something like that say that isn't skeptical. That's exactly the right language. And sometimes when you go to a concert, you can feel a power come upon you. When you go to a movie, you can feel a power come upon you. And the language of the Greeks of spirits coming upon us, when we fall in love, Cupid has taken up residence with us. This is a fairly secular narrative, and they're skeptical about the church's view of life because its connection to the Bible, and we're skeptical about spiritual powers, but we're not as skeptical as you might imagine. Now, there's an article that is very important to read in terms of many of these points. Slate Star Codex, Scott Alexander writes some of the best, one of the best blogs on the web, had a terrific piece July 8, Gay Rights or Civil Rights, RITES. First he went to Antigua in April because they have this Easter pageant, and he noted how the whole society has this pageant together. Now, Guatemala is hardly a state to be held up as the ideal. Not everybody, people are trying to leave Guatemala and going through Mexico to get into the U.S. at the southern border. Guatemala's had tremendous problems for a very long time, but talked about how the Easter pageant ties them together as a community, and talked about how in American civil religion, you know, we established this quasi-religious reality of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln at the top of the pantheon, and you have almost these angelic creatures on top of in statues, and you say, well, we don't believe in statues. Well, go to Washington, D.C. If a person time traveled from the ancient world into Washington, D.C., they would look at the Lincoln Memorial and say, there's the Temple of Zeus. And they'd look at the Jefferson Memorial and say, there's a temple. And they'd look at the MLK Jr. statue and say, well, there's an idol. That's the idol. We've made the image large. And Scott Alexander makes the point that as a society, we must have these embodied images, and we participate in them in a parade, and we represent them in the statues. And then he went on to a pride parade, how he went to San Francisco, and here are the rainbow flags right there in the airport, in the subway. And here you have a grown man with a t-shirt on that says, I love boys. And a woman, love is universal. And a dude whose butt I don't know who wants to see it, but you look at a gay pride parade, he's saying, well, this is gay rights, RITES, are civil rights. This is the hierarchy that we embody and participate in and manifest in. But here's where I'd take off from Scott Alexander's piece. The question is, these hierarchies have consequences. And they have consequences, maybe not in this generation, but generations down the line. And the coherence and cohesion of a hierarchy, well, it gets tested by time. And, you know, hierarchies that don't actually adhere well, they fall apart. And they are scattered as they go. Individualism, community, and well-being. I'm running out of time. Conversation with Adam, the Nazi loser argument that Nazi Germany had to lose the war because its hierarchy was And the Russians had to lose the war because it was unstable. And if you watch the movie, I highly recommend the HBO miniseries Chernobyl, because that is one of the best representations I've seen of how this plays out, of how the lie in a society where they can't tell the truth about radioactivity, or watch Benjamin Boyce's conversation with an endocrinologist. And what that means in terms of what we're doing to young people in this country. So what if my civilization fails if I get to be one of the elites that skim off the cream? And this is the challenge of individualism. How do I know well-being? It feels well for me. I'm a consumer. That's part of the hierarchy. And I should be able to consume that which I want. And it's a sense, countless conversations I've had with Daniel, probably countless more I'll have, where I'd say, Daniel, I want you to get into a home. Why do I want to pay rent? Well, what do you want? I want to live in this hazy world where I keep enough alcohol in my system where I don't have to think about everything. And I can just live in that blur. That works for me. Yeah, but you know what? It doesn't work for the neighbors, and it doesn't work for the neighborhood, and it doesn't even work for you to live in the terror of waking up sober. What if this is just one episode of a multi-story, multi-chapter life, existence, being? And because you're in the story, you can't read ahead. That's in a sense what Christianity asserts. Christianity asserts that, well, okay, so we're orienting everything from my little life now. And you might think, well, I'm a little bit more magnanimous. I'm going to be concerned about climate change because I want to leave a better world for future generations. What a noble idea. That's a wonderful thing. But what if you're curating your life based on 0 to 80 and death is done, when this is actually the beginning of a much longer thing? Even Steve Jobs, if you read the biography of Steve Jobs, I can't remember the author right now. He also wrote one on Einstein. You know, Steve Jobs, towards the end of his life, had been very spiritual in a way, been very New Age-ish in a way, very much into aesthetics and design. But at the end of his life, had sort of adopted a stance as an agnostic, as an atheist. There's no afterlife. And then towards the end of his life, as he realizes he's going to die of a disease that was curable if he hadn't tried to cure it by drinking fruit juice, he ponders and he wonders and he talks to his biographer, what if there's more after this? And you know, people wonder why churches are full of older people. Well, part of it is because of sort of the path of it. But also, once you get into your older years, and once you face death, this is something that medieval people faced all the time. But once you face death, you start to think, well, if I'm a story, my storiness, the storiness that I am, this doesn't go away when I die. Well, maybe this body goes away, but the story doesn't go away. And then when you look at the Christian resurrection, basically in Christian resurrection, it's not that you get a new body, like certain science fiction shows you can find on Netflix. You are reconstituted. But notice Jesus' resurrection, he still has the scars. So there's continuity between this story and the next story. And that's why, in many ways, the resurrection is such a central aspect of Christianity, because what the resurrection asserts is that it's, you know, watch The Matrix. There's aspects, shards, as Bishop Barron said, shards of the resurrection you can find in The Matrix. After Neo, in a sense, rises from the dead, you know, he can stop Agent Smith's bullets. He can fly. Jesus, at the end of the story, flies up to heaven. That's the way it works in the story. What if, in fact, as our hearts so often whisper to us, what if this story doesn't die with me? Yeah, my children will remember. Yeah, maybe I'll write a memoir. Yeah, maybe. But what if my story gets re-embodied? Well, that's going to change how I decide to spend myself in this life. You know, I'll tell you, dealing with Daniel takes time and is frustrating and is costly. But part of the reason I have a relationship with Daniel is because he decided to live for 5 years, literally sleeping against my office door, so that I had to walk over him. And every time I walked over Daniel, I thought of Lazarus and the rich man. Was Lazarus an alcoholic? I don't know. But every day I had to walk over Daniel just to get into my office. And when I'd be here at night, I'd hear him cursing his own existence. And when he was in a manic phase, he was trying to do things on the church property. I'm an asset, not a liability, he would tell me, and I'd roll my eyes. But how we treat each other, as C.S. Lewis points out often, is based on what we imagine each of us is. That's the end of the video, and I've got to go. But yeah, I'm hoping to do some more videos on this conversation and talk more about the church, because that's what really, what Barron and Peterson are doing is they're talking about the church and they're finding common ground between them. And one of the common grounds is, in fact, the goal. Peterson says, you have to have a goal that orients your life and changes how you see the world. And Barron says, yes, you have to have a goal, but Barron's goal is very problematic for many people. I don't think it's finally or fundamentally problematic. And that's perhaps where, John Vervaeke this afternoon and I will differ a bit. Thanks for watching.